Welcome to another edition of Socrates in the Studio, which falls under the rubric and maybe also the aegis of Socrates in the City. Today we find ourselves in the city of New York City. My guest is Massimo Piliucci, which you may be guessing is Italian. That would be correct. He is an eclectic figure. Let me tell you about him. He is the K.D. Irani Professor of Philosophy at the City College of New York, but he has a Ph.D. in evolutionary biology from the University of Connecticut. He has another Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Tennessee. His books include How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life, Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, and a handbook for new Stoics, How to Thrive in a World Out of Your Control. My guest now to talk about Stoicism and truth and all that fun stuff is Massimo Piliucci. Massimo, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's fun to talk about truth and life. I mean, this is what we do here, but this is something that you have been doing for some time. It's not every day that I bump into somebody who's written a book on Stoicism. And so the first question I always want to ask people is, how did you get to be who you are now? In other words, what is your story? I know you told me you grew up in Italy. Did you ever think you'd come to America? When you were a teenager, what were you thinking you would be doing in the future?
I had no clue about coming to America, but apparently, according to family lore, I decided to be a scientist when I was 5, I think. And that's because I watched the moon landing in 1969, and then at the end of that thing, I announced to my family that I was going to be a scientist.
Okay, don't tell the audience who's listening, but this means we're the same age.
Yeah, well.
And we're very young. We're very youthful,
young,
so they would never know.
Or at least
they would
not
never
too
know.
Old.
They would never know. So
that's how it got started. And in fact, sure enough, I did pursue science for many years after that. Initially, I wanted to be an astronomer, but then I switched to biology, so I got a degree in evolutionary biology, and that's when I moved to the United States, an undergraduate degree. Then I moved to the United States to pursue evolutionary biology because the University of Connecticut, where I ended up doing my PhD, was where one of my favorite biologists in my field, which is nature-nurture, gene-environment interactions, was working. So there it goes.
Did you ever play basketball for UConn?
No, but no. I did go to several of their games.
Okay. Well, so it's interesting to me. So at what point did you shift from science, and when we say science, I mean, in the classic sense of science, to philosophy, to what you are doing these days?
When midlife crisis hit, at some point I got through the standard academic career up to full professor. And then I thought, well, this has been fun, but do I want to do the same kind of thing for the next 20, 30 years, whatever it is that I have? The answer was no. So I started looking around. Now, this is not unusual. A lot of academics get mid-career and start pausing, take a sabbatical perhaps, and explore different avenues. What was unusual in my case is that I went a little bit further than other people in the exploration. Typically, you look at nearby fields, I don't know, from evolutionary biology to ecology, let's say. I went straight to philosophy of science. And that's because I actually had a passion for philosophy ever since high school, because I had a great teacher back in Rome. And I also, by chance, happened to have met a brilliant young philosopher of science who had just been hired at the University of Tennessee where I was working. So we got together, we became friends, and one thing led to another. And I got back to school and enrolled in the PhD program there.
Well, so you have two PhDs.
Yeah.
I have 5 honorary PhDs, which is equivalent to 0 PhDs. But I have to say that what's interesting to me is that, when you say I was interested in science as a little kid, to some extent, as I see it, what science used to be, it's similar in my mind, to philosophy. It's the search for truth. It's the idea that there's some world and I want to explore it, and then the question is how do I explore it as an astronomer, as whatever. But so to me, there is continuity between being a science and a philosopher.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the current sharp distinction between science and philosophy is an artifact of academic specialization. Probably inevitable because both disciplines have become very specialized, very focused on narrow areas of expertise because that's the way you make progress these days. However, historically, science did begin as natural philosophy with the pre-Socratics all the way back, you know, 2600 years ago. And then, especially during the so-called scientific revolution that started in the 17th century, you can think of science as essentially going through a process of spinning out of branches of philosophy. So physics was the first one, Galileo and Newton. Chemistry came after that with Boyle. Biology came after with Darwin. Psychology with James. And now we're into the 20th century. So all of these disciplines were philosophy, were natural philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as they became more specialized and more independent, intellectually independent, and then they started, you know, calling themselves something separate. But think about it this way. The term scientist was invented by William Whewell, who was one of the mentors of Darwin. So we're talking about 19th century. It's pretty late.
Yeah.
You know, before that, there was no scientist.
And it's interesting. At what point does science? I'm interested in the history of science, the philosophy of science, and so I always wonder: at what point did science veer toward materialism? I mean, it's interesting. I would guess the 19th century that somehow there was this crisis.
Yeah, I think that was a gradual process.
Yeah.
Right. So Galileo was one of the first ones to say, "Look, if we want to make a progress in terms of understanding of the world, we need to set aside, you know, scriptures, not because scriptures are not true, but because they're not helpful in terms of understanding the world.
Right.
Math and experimentation is helpful. However, Galileo certainly was a believer, so was Newton. When Newton introduced...
Well, I would argue that Galileo was more a believer than the people who shut him down.
Very likely.
That he had a higher view of the scripture than the people who shut him down, who were basically Aristotelians. That's another story. But it is fascinating that you have these major scientific figures, Galileo and Newton at the top of the list, who were definitely more than what we think of as scientists today, even though they were some of the greatest scientists who ever lived.
Yes. Now, by the time you get to Darwin, Darwin starts out as a believer, as a Christian,
yes.
And then he becomes agnostic,
right?
Partly because of his work, partly because of personal tragedy, the death of his daughter. And then after that, we enter into the 20th century, and things become more and more materialists with the advent of new physics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, things like that. So the latest that I know in terms of data about this is that a preponderance of scientists are non-believers. They're either agnostics or atheists.
Right.
Which, compared to the general population in the United States, is an anomaly because in the general population, the level of belief is about 90%. Wow. Among scientists is between 40 and 50%, depending on which sub-branch of science you actually are talking about. And if we're talking about the top scientists, the ones that are members of the National Academy, for instance, the percentage of believers goes down to 5%.
Interesting.
So it's definitely the case.
There seems to be a culture, as I say, and this is, you know, listen, we find this all around the world and in every discipline that, you know, if you want to move forward, there's certain things you're public about or quiet about or whatever. But what I always find interesting is Einstein. I only know this because I wrote a book called Is Atheism Dead? Where I explore the Big Bang and whatever. And when Einstein... I'm sure you know this, but when his equations revealed to him in the, you know, 19-teens that the universe is expanding, he was kind of embarrassed by the implications of it. He knew that the scientific establishment already over 100 years ago would say, this is too religious, this looks like creationism or something like that. So he buries it with his cosmological constant and then, you know, 15 years later has to admit, yes, I guess my equations were right. And, you know, so it's always fascinating to me to think that even over 100 years ago, the culture of the scientific world was such that you would be uncomfortable, I guess, by those kinds of implications toward something.
But that's understandable, right? I mean, science, at the basics, science is about evidence. And so scriptures by definition, doesn't provide evidence.
Yeah.
It's scripture. It's revelation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So it's pretty reasonable for a scientist to be uncomfortable with anything that is not based in evidence of some kind.
Well, no. In this case, the evidence was there for Einstein, pointing him toward something that made him uncomfortable because of the ramifications of it. That was the idea that there's a moment of creation. I think he just said, I don't want to deal with this. And so he kind of...
But it's interesting you put it in terms of a moment of creation. I would say there was a moment of beginning. That's not necessarily...
Oh, no, that's right. But what I'm saying is that if you say moment of beginning, enough people would say, this sounds too much like creation, this makes us uncomfortable. It made Einstein uncomfortable. But I'm just fascinated by the culture of science, the culture of the idea of scientism. But I certainly didn't expect to be discussing this with you today. I expect to discuss Stoicism with you. But I'm fascinated because to me, there is a continuum when we're just talking about truth. I mean, that's it. And whether it's truth via science or via philosophy, I think it's all part of the same thing. And so how did you transition from philosophy of science into philosophy itself?
Well, in order to become a philosopher of science, I thought I better take things seriously. And that's why I went back and got a PhD in philosophy. And that means you have to take graduate level courses in, ethics, metaphysics, ancient philosophy, and so on and so forth. And that was fascinating. That was really pushing me in directions that I had not anticipated. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the goal initially was to become a philosopher of science, which is what I do, in my day job at City College. That's what I do. I specialize specifically in what is called the demarcation problem, which is the distinction or lack thereof between science and pseudoscience.
I'm very interested in this, if you don't mind, because you wrote a book about it called Nonsense on Stilts,
right.
How to Tell Science from Bunk. Can you say a little bit about this? Because this is something, I mean, we've always dealt with it, but it seems like we're dealing with it now, generally speaking. What is the demarcation line for you? How do you think about it?
I think the agreement among philosophers at this point after... literally more than a century of discussions, because the first one to talk about this issue was Karl Popper at the beginning of the 20th century. So we're talking about literally a century of discussions. And I think it's fair to say that an agreement or a consensus among philosophers of science is that there is a distinction between science and pseudoscience, but it's not a sharp one. It's a continuum. So there are extreme cases that are pretty obvious, fundamental physics or chemistry. Those are sciences. Nobody in his right mind would sort of question that. At the opposite extreme, things like astrology, homeopathy, and things like that, those are definitely pseudosciences by any decent standard of evidence, reasoning, etc. But then there is the interesting stuff. There's stuff in between where at the moment you can't necessarily tell. You have to wait and see. For instance, up until recently, I would have put recently, meaning a few decades ago, I would have put parapsychology into the borderlines. For a long time, there were actual psychologists, academics who were doing research on things like telepathy and telekinesis and things like that. Now I think it's fairly settled. I think it's definitely sliding into the pseudoscience area. Mm. But I wouldn't be completely surprised if somebody actually published some new findings that sort of reversed the course. On the other side, there are things that people consider science, like the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for instance. It's done by astronomers. It uses radio telescopes, which are some of the most expensive equipment, scientific equipment you can imagine. Nevertheless, the theory is pretty shaky. I mean, there is essentially no theory. It's just a hope that whoever is out there has a psychology similar to human beings, and so they want to communicate, and then they're going to use similar technology to what we have. That's hope. That's not a scientific theory.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a shot in the dark.
Yes.
And sure enough, we've been shooting in that dark since the 1950s, and we've got nothing so far.
Right.
Again, this could change tomorrow, right?
Right.
We could wake up tomorrow morning, open the New York Times, and say, aliens found.
Right.
And at that point, it... Something
found, and then we have to figure out what it is that we found.
Right.
But, that's it's interesting. I think, again, that's exploring what are the limits of science or what is science. to me, I would say this is philosophy. This is to do real philosophy, to think about thinking.
That's right.
And to think about what does it mean to search for truth? Is there such a thing as truth? How can we know? What can we know? You know, that's what your average person is. We're living our lives trying to figure things out.
One way to understand what philosophers of science in particular do is to think about it this way. We have historians of science. Those are not scientists. Those are people who study science from the outside, from the development of science over time. We have sociologists of science. Again, they're not scientists. Mm. They're people who study science from the outside in terms of power structure, power relations, you know, social interactions, and so on and so forth. And then you have philosophers of science who, again, are not scientists. They're people who look at science from the outside and look into the logical proceedings, the warrant that scientists have when they reach certain conclusions. You know, why do they agree on certain things and not others? Right. Why are they interested in certain things and not others? That's what a philosopher of science does.
Right. Well, so I want to move into the world of Stoicism. How do you consider yourself, practically speaking, a Stoic? I mean, this is something that's valuable for you personally.
Yes, with some caveats. You know, I consider myself a Stoic practitioner in the sense that my general philosophy of life is definitely inspired by the Stoa, by a tradition that goes back 2,300 years. That said, we are here talking in the 21st century. Stoicism started in the 5th century BCE. So, you know, a few things need to be updated.
Yeah.
A few things need to be changed, and with regard, for instance, to whatever else has happened, both in philosophy and in science, in the intervening 2 millennia. So, I am a Stoic, broadly speaking.
Yeah,
but there are.
But you have found it practically valuable.
Yes, definitely.
Which is very interesting to me. Now, and say a little bit about the origins of Stoicism. You said it started in the 5th century BC, which so much seems to have done. But tell us about the beginnings of Stoicism.
Stoicism started with a guy named Zeno of Citium. Citium is in modern-day Cyprus.
Zeno with an X or a Z?
Zeno with a Z.
Z.
Not like to be confused with the Zeno of the Paradoxes.
I was going to say not to be confused with the Zeno most of us know from his Paradoxes.
Right. That one was Zeno of Elea, and he lived about a century earlier than Zeno of Cyprus or as in modern terminology. So Zeno was a merchant, and he was going to Athens on a ship with a cargo of purple dye, which at the time was very expensive. Big storm, ship goes down. Zeno survives, but he loses everything.
And this is before insurance was invented.
Yep, that's right. No insurance available. So
only a century later, he would have been.
Okay. He was done. So he makes it to Athens, and of course, what would you do if you just survived a shipwreck? Of course, you walk into a bookstore, of which there were many in Athens at the time.
Now, when you say a bookstore, obviously they didn't have bound books, but I'm surprised.
Like
I'm Greek, and I love that period, but I don't think of them as having bookstores. So even this is interesting to me.
But they did. They had things that you can roll out, and they actually had bounded books as well. Except that it were very expensive, and of course they were copied by hand. There was no printing press, right? So it was it wasn't exactly catering to the everyday man. You had to have a certain amount of money to take advantage of a bookstore. Mm. But Zeno walks in, and he hears the owner of the bookstore reading out loud a particular book, passages from a particular book, the Memorabilia by Xenophon. Xenophon was a friend of Socrates.
And Xenophon starting with an X.
Yes.
Just want to be clear.
Yes.
Okay.
He was a general, actually, but he was also a student and a friend of Socrates.
A general, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And he wrote the Memorabilia, which is about the life and philosophy of Socrates. And Zeno was just struck. He's like, wow, this is really interesting stuff. So he asks the bookseller, he says, where can I find me one of these people, meaning a philosopher? And the bookseller says, that being Athens at that time, he's like, oh, look, there is one outside the door right there, right now. Just go and follow him. That guy was Crates of Thebes, who was a member of the Cynic school of philosophy.
A real live Cynic.
Real live Cynic. So Zeno starts following him, and then over the following 10 years, he studies with all of the major philosophers in Athens.
So he found the Cynic was a little too cynical for him?
It was, the word cynical, actually, in the modern version, yeah. has very little to do with
right.
what these people were doing. Right. The cynics were pretty hardcore. They had no possessions at all. They were kind of itinerant monks. They owned nothing. They just went from one place to another, reminding people that there is a better way to live your life. Mm. It's like a monk. Imagine a monk who who goes around talking to people in the streets.
Now, was Socrates dead by this time?
Yes, he was. Socrates had been dead almost a century at this point.
Okay.
So Zeno, after several years, more than a decade, where he studies with a number of the major philosophers, with pretty much all the schools in Athens, decides that it's time to start teaching his own brand of whatever. He didn't have a name at that point. He picked a particular place to do that, a covered colonnade right off of the Diagora, the marketplace, which means a lot of foot traffic, right? People were coming in and out, shopping and stopping, buying, talking to friends and things like that. That particular colonnade had a lot of paintings on the wall of mythological and historical scenes from the history of Athens. And it was known as the Stoa Poikile, which means the painted porch. And that's where the word Stoicism comes, because Zeno started talking philosophy in the Stoa. And then after that, Stoicism became so popular that it became one of the two major philosophies throughout the Roman Empire, the other one being Epicureanism.
It's interesting that Zeno himself did not become so famous. I mean, most people have heard of Stoicism, but maybe we'd associate it with Marcus Aurelius. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and Marcus Aurelius, interestingly, is one of the last Stoics of antiquity. He lived in the second century. Stoicism survived as a philosophy until about the third century, and then it kind of went underground because of the rise of Christianity.
Because of the rise of Christianity, what is it about Stoicism that that Christianity pushed it away? In other words,
it wasn't just Stoicism. Christianity pushed away everything. So once that the Christians got hold of the Roman Empire, essentially, with Emperor Constantine declaring Christianity the official religion of the empire, they had access to resources, including the army, the Roman army, and the Roman roads and ways of communication, and so on and so forth. So at that point, all of the Hellenistic Greek schools of philosophy went in decline. Some were, in fact, shut down.
But not till the fourth century.
The process started in the late third century, and then, definitely accelerated with the fourth century. Yeah. It ended with the sixth century with the Emperor Justinian I, who was a Byzantine emperor. By this time, the Western Roman Empire has collapsed, so we have the Eastern Roman Empire. Justinian just declares by law that all of the schools have to be closed, all the philosophical schools have to be closed. The last one, the only one was still open, was Plato's Academy.
Right. Wow.
Yep. However, Stoicism, interestingly, survived in terms of ideas because it was actually fairly friendly to Christianity. The Stoics were big on things like, the universe is organized rationally and it's understandable rationally. So that goes well with the notion of a God and creator God and all that sort of stuff. The Stoics emphasized duty and virtue. Those things go pretty well with the Christian ethos.
Yeah.
Thomas Aquinas, arguably the most important theologian of the Middle Ages, came up with this classification of Christian virtues. The Christian virtues, there are seven of them. There are wisdom, courage, justice, temperance, hope, faith, and charity. Now, the first four are actually imported straight from the Stoics. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that the Stoics call the four cardinal virtues because they use them as a kind of a reference point to navigate life.
And you said wisdom, courage,
justice, and temperance.
Justice and temperance. Mm-hmm. So give us the nutshell version first of what is Stoicism. Somebody says, what is it basically? Because I think many of us have a kind of a pop culture sense of what it is. Mm-hmm. To be a Stoic, it's like saying, you're a cynic. We have a very one-dimensional concept of it.
Yeah. Yeah, Stoicism typically in modern language means being a Stoic means, stiff upper lip and suppression of emotions.
Yes.
Kind of Mr. Spock from Star Trek, let's say.
Right.
That's not at all what it is about.
And you said that Gene Roddenberry based the character of Spock on his misimpression of what a Stoic is.
That's right. And as much as I love Spock as a character, I really wouldn't want to live a life like that. So Stoicism is not about that, although there are reasons for that mischaracterization. Mm. Stoicism, one of the Stoic sort of sub-virtues, is endurance. The Stoics would say, which is connected to the distortion of the stiff upper lip, the Stoic would say, look, if something happens to you and you can't do anything about it, then your only choice is to endure it. I mean, what else are you going to do? Throw a tantrum? You're not a child. The notion of suppressing emotions also is not Stoic, but it does come from the idea that the Stoics had that some emotions are unhealthy and some are healthy. And so they thought that we need to come to terms with the unhealthy emotions and trying to limit them as much as possible, while on the other hand, we need to cultivate the healthy emotions. A typical unhealthy emotion is anger, because it's destructive, because it overrides reason. While a typical healthy emotion is, I don't know, love for your children or for your partner. Or
I mean, it's like hard to argue with that. In other words, I think that there's something just...
You'd be surprised.
I'm serious, because maybe you can give me an answer. Who would argue with that idea? Because the idea that some emotions are self-destructive and some of them are healthy, or that we need to temper our emotions or be in control of our emotions, it seems to be such a basic idea, at least at this point in history, that I would be surprised that anybody would argue against it.
And yet every time that I write something about anger from a Stoic perspective, I get a lot of angry people responding.
Well, we know there are angry people, but I would say they're just thoughtless in their anger, and the question is, how do they make a thoughtful case for their thoughtlessness?
Their case typically is that anger can have a positive effect.
Sure it can.
Right? That can be motivating, that it can move you to fight against an injustice and things like that.
Right.
And that is definitely defensible. It's not a bizarre idea. In fact, that's Aristotle's position. Aristotle differed from the Stoics.
And he was a hothead, though.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks, kind of they're kind of hot. Yeah. No, but so there. But I mean, I think you can see this to a point, right? That where do you draw the line between passion and anger?
Right.
Is there a line? I mean,
for the Stoics, there is. Any time that a passion overrides or interferes with your reason, it's not a good thing.
Right.
Right. So the Stoics about anger have a fairly radical position, which is definitely not Aristotelian. In fact, Seneca, one of the Stoics, at some point in a book called On Anger, which in my opinion is still one of the best books ever written on the topic, he criticizes Aristotle and makes fun of Aristotle. He says, you know, so this Aristotle guy, one of his arguments about anger being useful is, like, he says, you know, you want your soldiers to be a little bit angry before getting into battle because they're going to be more willing to fight, right? Mm. And Seneca says, sure, but by that token, soldiers are also more willing to fight if they are a little bit drunk. And you don't want a drunken army. You don't want somebody who is not in control of what they're doing, because otherwise, yes, they're going to fight, but they're not going to fight well.
Right.
So this discussion about anger has been going on for a long time. But anyway, let me go back for a second to the basic stuff. So fundamentally, Stoicism is about, as the Stoics themselves put it, living according to nature, which needs to be unpacked a little bit, because it's not about running naked into the forest and hugging trees or anything like that, although there's nothing wrong.
You mean living according to our nature?
Right. So perhaps one good way to grasp what they're getting at is the following. Imagine you invite me for dinner and at your place, and I come in with a bottle of wine, but I also have a present for you. It's a cactus plant, okay? Because I know you like cacti, and I'm a biologist. I like cacti as well. Now you're responsible for the cactus, for the well-being of the cactus. You better know something about cactus nature. Otherwise, you're going to kill it. If you think, oh, it's a plant, it just needs a lot of water and a lot of light, not going to go well, because it's a plant, yes, but it's a desert plant. So it needs a lot of light, but not a lot of water. If you give him a lot of water, it's going to die. Now, we are a little bit more complicated than cacti, but not that much. So if the question is, what is a good life for a human being? What is a flourishing life for a human being?
Right.
The Stoics thought, well, the first thing you need to ask yourself is, what is a human being? What kind of animal are we? And their answer was very specific. They said, look, other than the basic stuff that we have in common with other animals, you know, we need water, food, shelter, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That's fine. But that we have in common with pretty much everybody else. Mm-hmm. The things that are specifically human nature, according to the Stoics, are two. We are capable of reason. That doesn't mean we're always reasonable, right, or even frequently reasonable, right? But we're capable of reason. Reason is really our, in modern terms, we would say, reason is our evolutionary weapon. We do not have big muscles. We don't run fast. We don't swim fast. We don't fly. We don't know any of that stuff. But we're smart. Right? We are successful mm-hmm. in life. And by life, I mean sort of in general, against also, by comparison with other species, because we're smart. And second, we are highly social. Again, part of our success as a species is because we cooperate. We coordinate with other people, mm-hmm. and we're capable of solving problems, but this connection between being smart and being cooperative. Right. So, if that's true, then the Stoics thought the best human life is one where you cultivate reason, and you try to use reason to solve your problems, mm-hmm. and you cultivate your social attitudes. You become as pro-social, as cooperative as you can manage with your fellow human beings.
Well, that sounds so reasonable that it's surprising to me that anyone would argue with it. In other words, I don't know I guess the thing is that Stoicism is talking about something that it's reasonable to talk about reason. It's reasonable to talk about human beings as reasonable, rational, and. So I guess the question is, in what ways would Stoicism differ sharply from anything else? Because
in a number of ways. For instance, the Epicureans would say, yeah, this is all very nice, but really, fundamentally, what people want is pleasure.
Right.
And stay away from pain. And so the fundamental thing is pleasure and pain. And yes, we are smart and all that, but that intelligence is mostly used in order to stay away from pain and to seek pleasure.
That sounds like a cynical Freudian view of the world.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But it definitely is an Epicurean view of the world. And, it's reasonable enough. I mean, you can have arguments about it.
Yeah.
It's reasonable enough. Another criticism of the Stoics is like, well, there's too much emphasis on reason. What about emotions? The Stoics' response there tends to be, well, there is no sharp distinction between reason and emotions. Mm-hmm. Emotions are simply another way through which we think. Mm-hmm. It's what we will call intuitions and thinking on an intuitive level. But they would argue the only way you're going to have a good life is if your emotions align with your reasoning. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you have a crosstalk between your emotions and your reason and mm-hmm. you bring them together, if they are at odds, you got trouble, because it means you're going in one direction by way of reason and you're going in a different direction by way of emotions.
How does Stoicism deal with what I would call the transcendent? Because one of the other things, if you say, what is a human being? Humans differ from animals in the sense that we have always, in various ways, but always throughout human history, had an intuition that there's something beyond this world, or wanting to make a connection with whatever it is beyond this world. Just some innate sense that there's something. Some would call it spiritual, but I'll say transcendent. Does Stoicism deal with that, or does Stoicism exist apart from that?
It does, but deals with the transcendent in a rather surprising way. For the Stoics, there is nothing other than the world, the cosmos, and it's all made of matter. They're definitely materialists from that perspective. And to them, the transcendence comes out of realizing and remembering that we are completely interconnected to the rest of the cosmos. We're not a separate thing. We are bits and pieces, literally bits and pieces of the cosmos. They thought that the universe, they referred to the universe itself as God. They were pantheists by modern standards. And they thought that we're literally bits and pieces of God. We share in the properties of the universe, and that's where your transcendence comes. When Marcus Aurelius says, one of the things you should do is in the morning get up and go and look at the sun rise. Why do you do that? Well, because you want to remember, you want to remind yourself that you're not separate from that stuff. The stars are just as much part of the universe as you are, and it's a good thing to feel that communion at a deep level. And one way to do that is to expose yourself to an ecstatic experience with nature. That's where your transcendence, Stoic transcendence, comes in.
Interesting. And then the idea of, I mean, I was reading a little bit that the idea of virtue having to do with what I do ought not to be hedonistic or simply about pleasing myself, but Stoics would say that what we do ought to benefit others. Mm-hmm. Where does that idea come? Is that related to what you're saying?
Yeah, but the fact that it comes from out of the fact that we are social animals, and therefore we all thrive when other people do well. The way to have a society where flourishing is enhanced for everybody is to have a society where everybody helps each other. So
Right. There's
this connection that you have with other people. Other people also are, of course, part of the universe at large. They're also bits and pieces of the universe.
Right.
The Stoics were cosmopolitan. They thought of every other human being as a brother or sister,
mm-hmm.
right? No matter where they were on the planet. And so, of course, you have specific duties toward people that are near you simply by the fact that they're near you.
Mm-hmm.
So your family, your friends,
right.
your colleagues,
right.
etc., right? But it's not because they're inherently special. There's nothing special about you or about your family.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we're all human beings. And if you happen to have interactions with people on the other side of the world, you are supposed to treat them exactly in the way in which you would treat your family and friends.
These are all kinds of things that I would certainly agree with, and I think most people would agree with. But I guess then the question is, where do the Stoics find the, let's say, scientific evidence for this point of view? How is it not simply subjective?
Well, they thought of, interestingly, they thought of ethics as an empirical discipline, which is unusual even from a modern perspective. And I think they were right, but they were not the only ones. The Epicureans and other Hellenistic schools also thought of ethics as an empirical discipline, meaning that ethics is about figuring out what a good life for a human being is. And again, you can't do that unless you actually have empirical evidence about human nature. So they would say that what you need to do is to study biology, to study psychology, to study the way the world works. In fact, the Stoics argued that you need three fields of study in order to really live a good life. Ethics itself is directly concerned with what kinds of things are good for human beings and what kinds of mm-hmm. things are not good. But ethics, as I said, it's an empirical discipline. It depends on science, what they call physics, from physis, which is Greek for nature. Right?
Right.
So it's not physics in the sense of
right.
quantum mechanics.
Right.
It's physics in the sense of science in general.
Right.
And logic, because you need to be capable of thinking carefully and
right.
properly about certain things. Otherwise, you're going to make bad decisions. That's where the good life comes from. It's really sort of an empirical approach to things, which means that they were completely open, Seneca at some point, to change their mind about things. Seneca at some point writes a beautiful letter to his friend Lucilius, and he says, look, the people that came before us are not our masters. They're just our teachers. Much remains to be discovered. If we discover new truths, then it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do is to follow the new way if it is better. So that is a remarkable degree of open-mindedness about how to live your life. And the notion, to me, the notion that that is connected with knowing, learning about human nature is particularly welcome because as a scientist, as I said, I tend to go for the evidence. You know, whenever somebody makes a claim and says, well, this is going to make you happy, show me the evidence.
Right, right. That's very interesting. I've always been fascinated, as I was saying earlier, with this idea of transcendence and what we can know about transcendence or whether there is such a thing, whether there's evidence for it. And I've come to the conclusion that there is a lot of evidence for it, but it's difficult because you're dealing with something that it can be very easily, it can be subjective. And so it's kind of difficult. It's almost in a primitive state of discovery. How do we figure out, if your experience with the transcendent has any bearing on any universal transcendence
sure.
or it's just, and I think you mentioned something in the beginning of your book about your encounter with the new atheists. And I have to say, I always held them at arm's length until I wrote one of my recent books. And I was so disappointed in a way in their cavalier treatment of, you know, these are the subjects that have, you know, concerned mankind through the millennia. Yeah. And they tend to be tremendously dismissive and angry and in a way petulant. I was looking for something more in that, because I think I have so many friends that are agnostic or atheist, and I think that, you know, it's good to explore these things. But I found that the new, so-called new atheists did it very, very poorly.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the new atheists, there are differences among the new atheists.
Yeah.
Some are worse than others.
Yeah.
but yeah, there is anger. There is you know, as you say, a cavalier attitude toward longstanding traditions. At the same time, again, I'm with the Stoics and the Skeptics. One of the schools of thought, of ancient thought, that we have not talked about is skepticism. And I actually consider myself a skeptical Stoic. That is, I tend to adopt the fundamental skeptic notion that my beliefs should be proportioned to the available evidence.
But this is kind of Socratic, isn't it? I mean, wasn't Socrates a classic skeptic? I mean, because the word skeptic has a
negative connotation.
Has a negative connotation or a very abbreviated sense of what actual skepticism is.
I don't believe in anything.
Right.
Now, that's
right.
Not what skepticism is about. In fact, the word skeptic comes from the Greek, again, not surprisingly, skeptikos, which just means inquirer.
Right.
You know, a skeptic is somebody who says, okay, let's see. Let's figure out what's going
on. But I guess at what point, one of the things that I like about Socrates is that he questioned everything, but not in the way that many moderns question everything. In other words, he questioned everything because he believed there is such a thing as truth or wisdom.
Yes.
And so it's wise for us to question. But he didn't question to the point of cynicism or nihilism, which I think, in other words, when in the 60s people started saying question authority, the wise idea of questioning authority is we question authority to see whether it's legitimate, not to question the concept of all authority, which can become corrosive and nihilistic, which can lead to all kinds of negative things. And so there's a wisdom in a healthy skepticism, which I think Socrates had. But when you say that today, I think people, they grab it because they like the idea that I don't have to believe in anything. There's nothing worth believing in.
Right. It's an easy path, right? So question authority for questioning authority's sake, it's not a good idea. If I have a toothache, I go to the dentist. Why? Because dentists are the authority. Now, I want to make sure it's a really good dentist, for sure. But nevertheless, I'm not going to go to the car mechanic if I have a tooth problem, right? So questioning authority for its own sake, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Yes, this is Socratic. The skeptic approach is definitely Socratic. The academic, so-called academic skeptics, because they were members of Plato's academy later on. Plato was dead by this time. And they took a sort of a skeptic turn. These are people that are not well known to the general public. The big figures there are Carneades, who was a Greek, and Marcus Tullius Cicero, who was a Roman. But they explicitly said, all we're doing is what Socrates was doing, questioning things.
Right.
But notice one interesting thing. If you read the Platonic dialogues, the dialogues where Socrates is the main character and he asks questions to people.
Yeah.
Most of those dialogues end in a situation that the Greeks referred to as aporia, which literally means confusion. So you don't get an answer at the end of the dialogue. So there's for instance, one of my favorite is about the nature of courage. And so Socrates goes to a couple of generals, you know, military people, and says, surely if somebody knows what courage is it's a military person, right? I mean, you deal with courage all the time.
Is Alcibiades one of these?
Yeah, no, it's not.
It's not.
Because Alcibiades was a whole different kind of story. We could have a whole conversation
about
Alcibiades.
I know you've written about Alcibiades.
But so he goes to these two generals, Lysias and Nicias were the names. And he says, so explain to me, you know, what is courage? And one of them says, yeah, sure, Socrates. And he gives a first definition. And then Socrates says, okay, that's interesting, but... And the dialogue starts, and it keeps going like that. So Socrates raises objections. Nicias or Lycus go back and say, yeah, okay, so we can revise it this way and that way. You expect at some point the three of them to agree and say, ah, we got it. This is what courage is. Nope, doesn't happen. At the end of the dialogue, Socrates says, so I guess we don't know, do we? And the two generals said, yeah, I guess you're right. We really don't know. The point often of Socratic dialogues is not necessarily to have people agree on a particular notion, is to have them question the fact that they started out saying, oh, yeah, I know.
Right.
Right. The beginning of wisdom, according to Socrates, is realizing that you don't know as much as you think you know. Right. And that's what happens in almost all of the Socratic dialogues.
Right. And is this Plato's intention or Socrates' intention?
Well, that's you just raised what is called sometimes a Socratic problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Platzok.
We
have these it's very difficult to tell. Scholars tend to think that the early Socratic dialogues, the ones that Plato wrote when he was a little younger in his 40s, early 40s, reflect more closely what Socrates, the actual person, was saying and arguing. Part of the reason we think that is the case is because we have other dialogues written by Xenophon, the guy that I mentioned earlier on that so intrigued Zeno of Citium and got him into the path of philosophy.
Right.
Xenophon also wrote Socratic dialogues, and they kind of give you the same general impression of what Socrates was saying. By the time we get to the so-called middle dialogues in Plato's career, so later in his life, like the Republic, which is arguably his most famous, Socrates still plays a major role, but it's increasingly clear that Socrates is now a character in the dialogue who is talking about Plato's own ideas. By the end of Plato's life, we have some of the dialogues like the Laws and Statesmen, where Socrates either does not appear at all or is a minor character. And by that point, it's very clear that we have Plato talking. So it's kind of a continuum.
Right. Well, we have, I think, less than 10 minutes, so I just want to make sure that I don't forget anything. Stoicism seems, as I understand it, a way of dealing with life as it is.
Yep.
What does Stoicism have to say, or what is the range of what Stoicism has to say about death and the possibility of something beyond death? In other words, does Stoicism adamantly say we know there's nothing beyond this world or beyond physical death, or does Stoicism not deal with it, or say deal with what we think we know about on the question?
Some of the Stoics disagreed on that point. Seneca, for instance, seems to be, in some of his letters, seems to be open to the possibility that the soul, whatever that is, survives, at least for some time after death. Most of the Stoics thought, no, everything is made of matter, and matter decays, and there is no reason to think that anything is going to survive. Most of the Stoics were in agreement, surprisingly in this case, with the Epicureans. Epicurus famously said that there is no point in being afraid of death because where she is, you are not, and where you are, she is not. Meaning that death, by definition, is lack of sensation, and therefore you really don't exist. Once you're dead, you're done. The Cynics, interestingly, also agreed with that particular conclusion. The Cynics were those funny people who were around in rags and, you know, with no possessions. One of the most interesting of the Cynics was Diogenes of Sinope.
Okay, I was going to say Diogenes has to come up if you're talking about these guys.
And he was a really interesting character. At some point, there is a dialogue between Diogenes and some of his friends. And apparently Diogenes was getting on with age, so one of his students says, you know, so what do you want us to do with your body when you're dead? And Diogenes says, just throw it beyond the walls of the city. That's fine, that's okay. And the student is shocked, and he says, but that way, you know, the animals are going to go and get it, and, you know, and eat it. And Diogenes says, well, if you're concerned about that, just put a stick next to my body so that I can, you know, push away the animals. And the student says, but you're dead. You're not going to be able to use the stick. And Diogenes looks at him. He's like, exactly. It's not going to make any difference, is it? So a lot of the ancient schools were actually pretty materialistic from that perspective. No survival after death. The big exception there is Plato. Plato not only believed in an immortal soul, he even believed in reincarnation. He thought that we go through a set of cycles of birth and rebirth, and at some point, if we get good enough, we sort of eventually we get to this unspecified.
So who knew that Plato was Hindu?
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of similarities with the Indo or Buddhist perspective.
Well, I had just found personally that there seems to me so much evidence for the transcendent, even if we cannot say exactly what it is. I'm always puzzled by people who are so clear about what it's not or something like that, because I think there seems to me to be enough subjective evidence for something that a truly curious person would at least remain curious about it.
As I said, the Stoics and the skeptics were definitely curious, but you know, they would ask what kind of evidence.
Right.
And then we'll have a conversation about the nature of that evidence. Yeah. And apparently they were not convinced by whatever evidence was available at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, when we're talking about science and philosophy, I'm always fascinated by this, what we're talking about now, because to me there is tremendous evidence, but I think there is discomfort with exploring that evidence because it can lead to things that where people don't want to go, and they say so they just draw a line.
Let me channel my inner Cicero, since I'm writing right now a book on Cicero, and he was one of the skeptics. If we were sitting here and Cicero was talking to you, he would say, "Okay, so let's give it a try.
Right.
What sort of evidence are we talking about?"
Right.
What would you say?
I mean, I think I wrote a whole book called Miracles on the subject of miracles because I have known so many people who have had astonishing experiences, inexplicable, fascinating experiences. And I think either they're lying or they're hallucinating. They're making
they're
it
mistaken.
Up.
They're not necessarily hallucinating, but they're mistaken.
Or they're mistaken, sure.
Right.
Or it's just some subject. It's something they ate, you know. It's an old potato, a blob of mustard, you know. Not an actual ghost, as Scrooge says in Dickens's Christmas Carol.
Cicero will look at actually, interestingly, you mentioned miracles, because I have a friend in Italy at the University of Turin who specializes on the study of miracles. Cicero would probably say, well, yeah, but a lot of people have looked into that kind of evidence and then found it unconvincing on the ground that it's often the case either that people are, in fact, mistaken.
Yeah.
We know that eyewitness testimony is one of the least reliable kinds of testimony we have. This is from modern psychology, right? There's a lot of research showing that eyewitnesses are incredibly unreliable. We tend to think intuitively that the best kind of, you know, a jury in a trial is usually convinced by eyewitness testimony. But psychologists warn us that this is actually the least reliable kinds of, because we can make all sorts of mistakes. We can misinterpret something that we're seeing.
Yes.
We can misremember something that we think we saw and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the skeptic answer would be, okay, sure. Next time that I can come across a good evidence of a miracle, I'm going to look into it.
Yeah.
But there is reasonable doubt that this stuff is
actually again, I think it's healthy to have reasonable doubt,
right.
And because we know where these things can go in either direction, and I think, but it's at least fascinating to me to talk about it, because I do think that it's healthy to examine that kind of evidence. But we're getting far afield. We just have a few moments left. I think your book, which we have here, is How to Be a Stoic: Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life. What do you say to somebody who is simply saying, I don't know, I'm confused about life. What can Stoicism do for me? You know, I live in the 21st century. What is it about Stoicism that can appeal, that can help me navigate this difficult thing we call life?
Yeah. I think Stoicism, just like a lot of other philosophies of life, like Buddhism, for instance, can do two things. Number one, it provides you with a framework, with a well-thought-out framework, and with a set of priorities, a set of sort of way to organize your experiences, a way to make sense of your experiences. Whether you think the Stoic way of doing it is better than the, you know, Buddhist one or not, that's up to you. That's up to individual choices. But what a philosophy of life does is it provides you with a way to organize your thoughts, to rank your priorities, to state more clearly to yourself your objectives, your goals. That saves you a huge amount of time, right? The second thing that it does, and that's, I think, the major reason why Stoicism is so popular these days, is it comes with a set of techniques, with a set of actual tools that can be used in order to navigate whatever challenge you happen to face. For instance, let me give you just one short example. One of the things that I trained myself to do early on, since I started studying Stoicism, is to apply what Epictetus, who was a second century Stoic philosopher, calls the fundamental rule. And the fact that he calls it a fundamental rule tells you it's important. He says, whenever you're facing a challenge or a potential setback or, you know, some difficult situation, ask yourself, stop, don't do anything, stop, and then ask yourself the question, what here about this particular situation is up to me and what is not up to me? Make a list, actually make two lists, of things that are up to you, meaning things you can actually act on, right, where your agency is potentially efficacious, and things that you cannot act on because your agency has nothing to do with it. And then what you do is you direct all of your attention to the first list, and you work toward accepting with equanimity whatever is on the second list. Let me give you a very simple day-to-day example. I travel a lot. So, of course, I get to the airport sometimes and, you know, the flight is canceled. Now, a lot of people get angry. They start yelling at the poor employee of the airline who really doesn't want you to be there. He would much rather have you on the plane and so on and so forth. That's not useful. The approach that Epictetus suggests would put, you know, magically solving the problem into the column of not up to me. It's not up to me to actually make suddenly the flight come back and everything work out. That's not going to happen. So forget it. Get it out of your mind. What is up to me is while everybody else is wasting their time yelling and, you know, cursing and all that sort of stuff, I get on my phone, I get the airline app, and I get myself rebooked on a new flight before everybody else does it. Once I've done that, what is up to me is to walk to the bar and get a nice glass of wine, open up my laptop and catch up with my email, or open up my book and catch up with my readings. Those are all things that are up to me. They're actionable. They make me feel in control. Therefore, they also sort of calm down, essentially, any kind of emotional reaction you might have because you're in charge. You feel like you're in charge. All of these other stuff, you know, oh, now I wish I could still make the original appointments that I... The fact that you wish it means nothing.
Right.
The universe has decided that for whatever reason, that's not going to happen. So just deal with it. Just accept it.
Right.
Remind yourself that the fact that a flight is delayed and you're missing a meeting, that's just how the world works. It is in the nature of flights at airports to occasionally be canceled.
Right.
And if you expect never to be affected by that sort of stuff while everybody else is, then you're a fool.
It sounds to me what I'm appreciating is that there's immense practicality and wisdom in what we're talking about. It's about being thoughtful, and I think one of the things that I often see, you know, in modern Christianity, for example, is a lack of how to and the idea that we do need to be mindful of. We need to have tools.
Yeah. And if you think about it, you just mentioned modern Christianity, but if you think about it, what I just said, the, you know, some things are up to us and other things are not up to us. Here's what you do with one and here's what you do with the other. Sounds a lot, or it should sound a lot, like the Serenity Prayer.
I was going to say, there's no doubt that it sounds like the Serenity
Prayer.
Right,
and it's not by mistake.
Right.
Or it's not by chance. So the Serenity Prayer asks, you know, you ask God to provide you with the wisdom to tell the difference between what you can change and what you cannot, the courage to change what you can, and the serenity to accept what you cannot.
Yeah.
That's essentially a rephrasing of Epictetus's fundamental rule. The reason for that is because Epictetus' manual, which is where the rule appears, it's right at the beginning of the manual. It's 1.1, section 1, subsection 1 of, of Epictetus' manual. It was used as a training manual for Christian monks throughout the Middle Ages.
No surprise.
That's one of those things that I said. Yeah. That's how Stoicism survived throughout up to modernity.
Well, wisdom is wisdom.
Yes.
I'm sorry we're out of time. It's been very enjoyable to speak with you, Massimo. And I forgot to say earlier how much I enjoy your name, Massimo Piliucci. We don't have a lot of Massimos around here. It's a beautiful name. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. Thank you for the book, How to Be a Stoic. And folks, that concludes today's session of Socrates in the Studio.